Father in heaven, we thank you for the opportunity of returning for a further study of the operation of your Holy Spirit through your special messenger to this people. We invite the teaching ministry of your Holy Spirit this afternoon. May he lead us and guide us into all of the truth we're capable of comprehending, and we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. If you will turn to page 79 in your collection of outlines. First of all, let me update the footnote at the bottom of the page. A digest of this material was published in the ministry of April 1986. And incidentally, that has been reproduced in the anthology which Dr. Olson gave you, I presume, last week, pages 214 to 218. Several of the things in this outline will not be in that presentation, and I think there are several things in that presentation that are not in this outline. However, the article, as it appeared in the April ministry, contains approximately half of the material that I sent to the Pacific Press. They are bringing out a 32-page booklet under the title that this lecture is listed on the top of the page, and that is still scheduled for release from the Pacific Press on July 31, so that's about 9 days from now, and I presume it will be in the Adventist Book Center shortly thereafter. It will contain twice as much material as appeared in the article in Ministry Magazine, and about twice as much as what we've got here on these few pages of this outline. Some of you may have already read the article in Ministry. This will be a review for you then. Regarding criticisms made against Ellen White in her professional capacity as a prophet, I have yet to find even one of the contemporary charges that either has not previously been made against a Bible prophet or that was not previously raised against her during her lifetime. And the integrity issue, as I have labeled it, was raised as early as 1867 with regard to allegations of literary borrowing. This morning we spoke about the first health reform vision, June 6, 1863. That is the first comprehensive one. That was 1863. And 4 years later, in 1867, in the Review and Herald, there were questions being raised in a question and answer column, which she answered with her initials at the end of her response about had she borrowed material from some of the contemporary health reformers. And as early as 1908, the integrity issue was raised with regard to alleged discrepancies between her public teaching and her private practice vis-a-vis vegetarianism. I think all of this needs to be looked at under the context, or in the context, of what Ellen White said would be the very last deception of Satan in this church. Selected Messages, Book 1, 48. Satan would attempt to do two things: to destroy her credibility as an authentic prophet and to create a satanic hatred against her writings. His purpose, I think, seems clear. If he can destroy the prophet's credibility, then Christians will not read, or if they read, will not take seriously the writings of the prophet. He'll have things more his way. And I think attacks on Ellen White's credibility and integrity must be seen in this light. This presentation will focus on the accusations that she was devious and hypocritical when she mandated vegetarianism on her church as a result of that first major comprehensive health reform vision of 1863, while secretly continuing to eat flesh foods and unclean ones at that for the next 31 years. First of all, what was the public teaching and what was the private practice? I've given you here three examples that are typical of critical attacks which allege hypocrisy. The first one is D.M. Canright, who is reported to have charged in 18, that he saw both James and Ellen White eating ham right in their own home. And this may be true. Notice the facts. Canright first met James White in 1859 and was converted. Does your outline say "and baptized"? Circle the word baptism and put a little question mark in the margin. I am not sure that White, James White, baptized him, that is, did the actual rite. He did convert him to the Seventh-day Adventist Church in evangelistic meetings, and he did give him his first evangelistic charts and a Bible and send him out to preach. I am not sure that he performed the rite of baptism, so put a little question mark there. We might want to check that out a little further. After he became an Adventist, Canwright was thereafter a frequent and welcome visitor in the White home. I almost said the White House, but that might have been misleading. It was not until 4 years after they first met, that Ellen White was given her first vision contraindicating meat in general and pork in particular for Adventists. That's the vision we talked about this morning. By the way, if you are into Adventist trivia, let me point out that the vision, as far as the calendar is concerned, was June 5. Ellen White always dated it June 6, because even as late as 1863, they were calculating time by the Bible method. This was on a Friday night after the sun had set, and so June 6 was actually Sabbath on the calendar. But since she considered Friday night Sabbath, she dated her vision June 6. On the calendar, it would have been June 5. So in case somebody says, hey, you got the date wrong by one day. No, we didn't. We're using her date, but we're explaining the discrepancy. Now, prior to that first major health reform vision, Ellen White probably ate pork, probably served it at her own table. In view of this, it's not only possible, but even probable that Canwright saw the Whites eating pork in their own home. They gave it up in 1863, however. Now, that's the first critical attack. The second, George B. Starr is alleged to have discovered Ellen White in a railroad station in Chicago, a railroad station restaurant, sitting behind a protective screen, eating raw oysters with vinegar, pepper, and salt. Charge was made by Fanny Bolton in a letter to Mrs. E.C. Slauson of December 12, 1914, and is included in a big document that we have. It's about 120-some pages, called The Fanny Bolton Story, a collection of source documents. And that's incidentally where the critics got it. If we hadn't put that document out, they wouldn't have had that ammunition. So you see, we're guilty of helping the critics. When Willie White got wind of this charge, he wrote to Elder Starr and asked him, you know, is this really true? Starr replied, and incidentally, Willie's letter and Starr's letter is all found in this collection, source documents. Starr replied, the accusation was the most absurdly untruthful lot of rubbish I've ever seen or heard. The event simply never occurred. Annie Bolton's statement is a lie of the first order. A third charge is again attributed to Fanny. She reported that on a certain trip in a railroad coach, Willie got off the train, brought back a thick piece of bloody beefsteak, which Sarah McInturfer cooked in the coach and was promptly eaten by the traveling party, including Ellen White. And Willie White explained that in a letter back to Starr. He said about 35 members of a traveling party were going from Battle Creek to Oakland, 1884. By the way, does your outline say 1884? We had a secretarial typographical error in one of the reincarnations of this thing, and it came out 1984, which is a little late. 1884, by rail, in two skeleton sleeping cars. Bob, what is a skeleton sleeping car? Do you know?
Well, I guess
well, they may have felt like skeletons by the time they got to the West Coast because it took some weeks.
I imagine, Roger, it should have skeleton facilities, wouldn't you think so?
Yeah, either unlined. I have traveled in a skeleton airplane out in Africa, which meant that it had no lining. So I'm guessing that's what a skeleton sleeping car is. Anyway, it was attached to a freight train. I don't think I'd ever want to ride even in a passenger car attached to a freight train. We were many days on the journey. Well, they were thus delayed by the time the train, and cross out that S on the word train, reached the Nevada-California border. Provisions were running low. And so at one stop, Willie got off the train, purchased 2 or 3 pounds of freshly killed ox. They believed the animal was healthy. The risk of acquiring disease was slight. Fresh fruit in this place at this time of year was very expensive and very scarce. And then we have this very interesting and revealing statement by Willie White, which we will come back to because it's going to help us develop a definition from Ellen and Willie White, a definition as to what a vegetarian is. For years, Willie wrote, the White family had been vegetarians, but not teetotalers. Do you know what the word teetotaler means? A teetotaler is a person who abstains 100% from anything. It is usually applied to alcohol. If somebody says, I'm a teetotaler, that means he doesn't touch any form of alcohol at all. Willie is using it here in connection with vegetarianism, and he said that for years the White family was vegetarian, but not teetotalers. Now, some people would say that's a contradiction in terms. Well, it isn't the way Willie's using the term, but we need to understand how Willie's using the term. We had always reckoned in cases of emergency, and now we're beginning to get a clue to the exceptions to the habitual practice of vegetarianism. In cases of emergency, it was justifiable to eat sparingly of clean meats. On this particular occasion, 8 or 9 years before Ellen White decided at the time of the Melbourne camp meeting, Brighton, January 1894, to be a teetotaler, as regards eating of flesh foods, they felt this was an emergency. He goes on, you'll find in Sister White's writing several instances where she says flesh meats do not appear on our table, and this was true. During a number of years, when on rare occasions a little meat was used, it was considered to be an emergency. Now, I might just add a parenthetical observation here about credibility of witnesses, because in any evidentiary inquiry, the credibility of the witness is a legitimate consideration. In the case of Canright and Fanny Bolton, both of them were known by their contemporaries for instability of character and instability of personality. Both had an in-and-out experience. Fanny with employment. She was hired by Ellen White, and then Ellen let her go, and then she came back and then was let go, and it was kind of back and forth. Canright, as far as his being a minister in the church he was in, he got discouraged. He was very easily discouraged, and then he went out. I think he was a little paranoid. He felt that people were persecuting him. He at times felt he wasn't getting his just due, and he was in and out, in and out, in and out. Finally, he stayed out. So both Fanny and Dudley Canright were known for instability. And it is not unfair nor unkind to comment at this point that Fanny Bolton was institutionalized for mental illness on two different occasions for a total of, it's either 10 and a half months or 16 and a half months. I can't read my own handwriting. I think 16 and a half sounds about right, both periods put together. So some of the things that she said perhaps can be understood in that light. Okay, down at the bottom of page 80, a chronology, teaching, and practice. As we mentioned yesterday, the gift of prophecy was given in December of 1844 to a 17-year-old Sunday-keeping pork eater, and the vision was silent concerning the significance of the Sabbath or vegetarianism. First vision dealing with the Sabbath would not come until April 3, 1847, incidentally 7 months after James and Ellen White started keeping the Sabbath from Bible evidence. These people who say we got our doctrines from the visions of Ellen White are very uninformed. James and Ellen kept the Sabbath 7 months. They got a copy of Bates's little 48-page document. It was too small to call it a book and too big to call it a document, or I heard a pamphlet. Yeah, it's too big to be called a pamphlet and too small to be called a book. It was 48 pages. And they started keeping the Sabbath from the Bible evidence contained in the pamphlet. And it was 7 months after that that they started keeping the Sabbath then, and it was 7 months after they kept the Sabbath that she had her first vision on the subject. That's worth noting. The first vision dealing with health matters wouldn't come until the autumn of 48, and the first major vision would be June of 63, as we noted this morning. Well, let's look at Ellen's health condition at the time of her first vision. And remember, how old was she when she had her first vision? 17. She was just barely 17. Her birthday was November 26. Now, we don't know the day of the month in December, but she was really just barely 17. All right, she herself, and we're working from her words here, faintness in the stomach, dizziness in the head with frequent fainting spells, loss of appetite in the spring, weak, feeble. And incidentally, there's a little source reference note here that these crosshatch marks, you know, number 4, number 27, refer to numbered, enumerated sections of Appendix 1, Councils on Diet and Foods. The remedy that was attempted was eating meat daily, and some people do that today. She characterized herself as a great meat eater and characterized meat as my principal article of diet, with the result that there was a temporary alleviation of symptoms, but instead of permanent strength, she progressively grew weaker and weaker, often fainting from exhaustion. On October 21, 1858, the only vision dealing with health, with the flesh foods prior to 1863 came in connection with Brother and Sister A, and we've established that that was Stephen Haskell. And again, if you are into Adventist trivia, Stephen Haskell received more letters from Ellen White than any other person apart from the immediate members of her family, her husband or her two sons. Stephen Haskell got more letters from Ellen White. And Stephen had a problem in some things. He was very zealous. Stephen Haskell was teaching verbal inspiration, if I'm not mistaken, Bob. Is that right? Stephen Haskell was teaching verbal inspiration, and she wrote and she said, "Hey, brother, you're making my work awfully hard," because he was teaching the wrong view of inspiration, mechanical verbal view of inspiration. Now, Haskell is not simply telling people, and please note this distinction because it is important. Haskell was not simply telling people, don't eat pork. Haskell was making the eating of pork a test of fellowship, which Ellen White said, if the Lord wants it that way, he's going to let us know through the authorized channel. Incidentally, in manuscript 15 of 1889, she herself said that the eating of pork was not a test question. And on volume 1, page 206, to Haskell, she said, "In your judgment and opinion, you have made this question a test." The implication is he'd done it wrongly. So the issue is not Haskell telling people don't eat pork. The issue was he was making it a test question. In volume 9, 159, she says, "We are not to make the use of flesh food a test of fellowship, period." So not only is pork not a test of fellowship, but eating any kind of flesh food is not a test of fellowship for Ellen White. Well, she did not say it was all right to eat pork. Some people have wrongly interpreted that statement in Volume 1, but the issue was making it a test of fellowship. Okay, June 6, 1863, the first major comprehensive health reform vision. First of all, the vision, characterized by Ellen White as great light from the Lord. I didn't seek it. I didn't study to obtain it. It was given me by the Lord to give to others. And she further characterized it as a general plan. As it would be received and practiced, disease and suffering would be greatly lessened, and it would be a progressive work. Her response, she said, "I accepted the light on health reform as it came to me. Since the Lord presented this vision, I've left the use of meat. Further, I broke away from everything at once, meat, butter, three meals a day, and so on. I at once cut meat out of my bill of fare." And the result, worth noting, the former faintness, dizzy feelings, loss of appetite in the spring, etc., left her permanently, and at the age of 82, in 1909, she could say, "I have better health today, notwithstanding my age, than I had in my younger days." But it was not without a battle. Now, she had a battle with several things. Vinegar, which wouldn't have been a battle for me, but it was for her. In discontinuing the use of vinegar, she experienced a struggle which sorely afflicted her for many weeks, but in the end, victory came. And in the discontinuance of her heavy flesh diet, Ellen White described the ensuing struggle and trauma as a special battle which she had to fight. But the next year, "I've lived nearly a 1 year without meat," and in 1869, writing to Edson and urging him to avoid meat, and she says, "We have in diet been strict to follow the light the Lord has given us. We have advised you not to eat butter or meat, and we haven't had it on our table." 1870, "I haven't changed my course a particle since I adopted the health reform. I've not taken one back step or one step back since the light from heaven on this subject first shone on my pathway. I broke away from everything at once. Should we then conclude that this meant that Ellen White never again ate a piece of meat? And the answer is no. She did on occasion, as we will notice, and she didn't attempt to hide the fact either. In 1890, she wrote, "When I could not obtain the food I needed, I sometimes have eaten a little meat." And in 1901, she spoke of times when I was compelled to eat a little meat. I have gone through her writings, and I have come up with three categories. Now, I might mention that in the article for Ministry Magazine, they cut my first category into two. So in that article, you would read four categories, and here I'm giving you three. In the book that's coming out at the end of the month, I think it'll be three there. But the editor of Ministry thought that I had two different discrete categories under number one, and so he divided number one into two. So that explains why they have four categories and there are three here. The first category, in which there were compromises necessary because of circumstances, was in travel. When James and Ellen itinerated in the field, they sometimes were obliged to eat meat because they were dependent on the hospitality of the host in whose home they stayed. They couldn't afford to stay in hotels, and they couldn't afford to eat in restaurants. They had to stay with our people. And especially in those early days, people were too poor to be able to afford much in the way of fruits and vegetables. Let me add a parenthetical statement at this point. This was hard for me to accept when I first read it. I'll be totally honest with you. Because in this country, meat costs more than fruits and vegetables, doesn't it? But you know, a few weeks ago, I was in a place where it didn't. And for the first time, the force of this hit me. I was in Argentina. Incidentally, I was advised in Argentina to soft-pedal vegetarianism, not to make my presentation. I said, "Thank you very much. I made it, but I made it only after a great deal of extra prayer, asking the Holy Spirit to be able to make me be able to say it in a kind way, in a way that would be winning and not judgmental and would gain acceptance." And I tell you, the Lord really did. Of all the presentations that I've made of this subject, I think the Lord especially blessed the one in Argentina. Maybe I prayed more over that one than I did over today. I don't know. But anyway, in Argentina today, meat costs less than fruits and vegetables. And it doesn't appear, and when I first read this, this was why they did it, was because they were too poor to afford fruits and vegetables. I said, "Hey, meat costs more than fruits and vegetables." But it didn't, apparently, in this country. It didn't in Australia in the 1890s when Ellen White was there. And in South America, you know, the government of Argentina would be delighted if everybody became a vegetarian, because they are, in fact, the government of Argentina is encouraging vegetarianism. It has nothing to do with health. They want more beef to be able to send overseas to export to get more foreign exchange. So they are happy with any efforts put forward to getting people to become vegetarians. But meat is cheaper in Argentina than fruits or vegetables today. And we have some poor people, some poor members in Argentina who can afford meat, but they can't afford fruits and vegetables. Some of you will say that's a cop-out. No, it really isn't. And if it were, I would be the first to shout cop-out, because I'm very allergic to that kind of cop-out. All right, here are some difficulties. First, 1873. Ellen and James are in the mountains of Colorado. They were traveling up there. Their wagon, their carriage broke down. Mr. Walling went to get something repaired, and he took longer to get back than they expected. Their food was running out. They were in a terrible situation. And if you read, and incidentally, in my original manuscript, I had a day-by-day, blow-by-blow account of what she wrote in her diary and the cumulative effect of that. I mean, each day you can feel the anxiety and the panic, the near panic rising a little more each day, several weeks there. So anyway, she said a passing hunter gave them a small piece of deer, which he killed 20 miles down the road and had carried on his back. And she said, "We made it into broth, and Willie shot a duck." Willie is also reported to have shot a squirrel. I don't know whether it was on this trip or some other time, but it might have been on this particular trip. 5 years later, in the mountains, Ellen again told her husband to fish and hunt. On Christmas Day, 1878, at Denison, Texas, the Whites invited a destitute Adventist family to join them for breakfast. And in a document here, letter 63 of that year, she gives you a menu that they had. A quarter of venison cooked with stuffing. And she was honest. She said it was tender as chicken and we all enjoyed it very much. There's plenty of venison in the market, she wrote. Though I am adding, probably there wasn't much else, because she immediately adds, I have not seen in years so much poverty as we have seen since I had come to Texas, 1878. 1895, Ellen White's in Australia. She writes to A.O. Tait, I've been passing through an experience here in Australia that is similar to the experience I had in Newfields in America in the earlier decades. I have seen families whose circumstances would not permit them to furnish their table with healthful food. Unbelieving neighbors have sent them in portions of meat from animals recently killed. They made soup out of it. They supplied their large families of children with meals of bread and soup. And then this interesting statement, it was not my duty, nor did I think it was the duty of anybody else, to lecture them on the evils of meat eating. I feel sincere pity for families who've newly come to the faith and who are so pressed with poverty they do not know from whence their next meal is coming. So the first category had to do with travel and those kinds of situations, especially in areas of poverty. The second category of my three deals with transition with a new cook. Now, in addition to her own extended family, which often included helpers in literary and other lines, there were many who called at Ellen White's door from day to day who were, through the gracious hospitality of this woman who preached hospitality, invited to stay for a meal. And there were people who took advantage. And several times she lamented in her diary, I don't think the Lord expects me to run a free hotel. She was human. And it was not uncommon. I have been able to establish that 16 to 20 persons, guests, at a meal any given day was not exaggeration. I can give you documentation if you think 16 to 20 visitors a day or a meal would be unusual. Manifestly, she could not herself attempt to cook all those meals, and she employed a cook as one of her household help. Now, especially in the earlier days, it was difficult to find a cook who could cook vegetarian meals. During the first few days of training and breaking in such a person, the family, temporarily, would have to eat what the new cook knew how to cook. Perhaps this explains the following lament penned in Australia in 1892. Incidentally, this isn't the favorite quotation of many Australians. I am suffering more now for want of someone who is experienced in the cooking line to prepare things I can eat. And then a little hyperbole, I would pay a higher price for a cook than for any other part of my work. Now, this will be in the book when it comes out at the end of the month. It's not in this outline, and I don't think this is even included in the article as it appeared in Ministry. But I found a Willie White letter in 1935, as written by Willie in 1935, which means that this was written about 2 years before Willie died, because I think he died in 37, if I'm not mistaken. And he was explaining this to somebody, and this is what Willie wrote. Sister White was not a cook, nor was she a food expert in the technical ways which come from study and experimentation. Often she had serious arguments with her cook. She was not always able to keep the cook which she had carefully indoctrinated into the vegetarian ideas. The cooks would often, they were young women, leave, get married, and then she'd have to start all over again. Those she employed were always intelligent young people. As they would marry and leave her, she was obliged to get new cooks who were untrained in vegetarian cookery. In those days, we had no schools as we have now where our young ladies could learn the system of vegetarian cookery. Therefore, mother was obliged, with all her other cares and duties, to spend considerable effort in persuading, to spend considerable effort in persuading her cooks that they could do without meat or soda and baking powder and other things that were condemned in her testimony. Can't you see Ellen White arguing with her cook? Say, yes, we can do without baking powder. We can do without meat. No, you can't. Yes, we can. No, you can. You know, interesting. How would you ever argue with a prophet? Have you ever wondered what it would have been like to have been James White and married to a prophet? How could you ever win an argument? I mean, you know, she always has the last word. She's had a vision. Well, anyway, she had arguments with her cooks. Oftentimes, our table showed some compromises between the standards which Sister White was aiming at and the knowledge and experience and standard of the new cook. I thought that was interesting, and I'm glad they left it in the extended presentation, which will be in this little 32-page book at the end of the month. Okay, there was a third category in which Ellen White might temporarily depart from a habitual practice of not eating flesh foods. And this is in the medical or therapeutic emergency situation. While Mrs. White, early, 1848, advocated avoidance of the use of tea as a beverage, she did use it therapeutically. We mentioned this yesterday, didn't we? In cases of severe vomiting and migraine headache, she said, I took it as a medicine, not a beverage, but as a medicine. And just so, there were instances when she used and permitted the use of meat in medical emergencies. 1874, she wrote to Willie, mentioned an interesting singular exception. Your father and I have dropped milk, cream, butter, sugar, and meat entirely since we came to California. However, your father once bought meat for May. That was May Walling, a grandniece of Ellen White's, while she was sick, but not one penny have we expended on meat since. And then, a meat diet is not the most wholesome of diets, and yet I would not take the position that meat should be discarded by everyone. Those who have feeble digestive organs can often use meat when they cannot eat vegetables, fruit, and porridge. And she indicated that in certain cases of illness or exhaustion, in cases where consumptives, that is people with tuberculosis, were going steadily down to the grave, where persons with tumors are running their life away, it would not be wrong for them to eat a little meat, though even here the animals should be in good health and free from disease. And now I raise a rhetorical question. Could there be a fourth category? I have given you three. Could there be a fourth category of exception, and you'll note the word exception is in quotation marks, a fourth category of exception to the habitual practice of vegetarianism, instances where the family was growing maybe a little careless, or worse yet, where Ellen White was fighting the battle of appetite. Now, she tells us herself she loved the taste of meat, where she might have slipped and lost temporarily the battle. And I think the answer is it's possible. I'm looking for one. I haven't found one yet. But if I do, I'm going to put it in my outline. But supposing I should find a documented instance in which Ellen White temporarily slipped and lost the battle with appetite, the battle with temptation. If I do, I can tell you now it will not cause me to lose confidence in her as an authentic, legitimate prophet of the Lord. And I also do not believe that it could be used as conclusive evidence of the charge of hypocrisy leveled by the critics. It would simply be another evidence that Ellen White, like all the other prophets before her, was a human being who sometimes failed in a struggle with temptation. Can you give me one example from Scripture of a prophet who never succumbed to temptation at all? Jesus, yeah, that's the only one you can give me. There's not another one of the prophets of the Bible who wrote the Bible that didn't occasionally have a problem with falling to temptation. So if one's going to throw out her writings because she fell into temptation, then to be consistent, one must throw out the Bible, for it was written entirely by men who, though inspired by the Holy Spirit, still occasionally lapsed into sin. Now, somebody made this analogy, and I'm going to share it with you. I agree with you in advance. This is gross. But it is legitimate. Supposing we found evidence that Ellen White had an affair with a minister in the church. And let us suppose that she arranged to have him murdered to keep him quiet. What would you think of Ellen White? Would you throw her out? Well, David did that, didn't he? We haven't thrown the Psalms out, not a one of them. We haven't thrown the Psalms out. I never thought of it quite that way before. I didn't invent, Dr. Olson's looking at me with rather bleak eyes here. I didn't invent that analogy. I probably am capable of it, but I didn't. But I heard somebody else use it. And, you know, really, I mean, David, he lusted, he committed adultery, he committed murder, he committed a Watergate cover-up, and what did the Lord call him? A man after my own heart. Abraham, who lied twice. Have you ever done the same thing wrong twice? Now, I could forgive Abraham for lying to Pharaoh, but then he turns around, goes to another king, Abimelech, tells the same lie. Have you ever committed the same sin twice? We all have. And yet, what was Abraham's title? The friend of God. David, a man after God's own heart. I would point out that those titles applied not because of their sins, but in spite of their sins. And folks, I'm glad that's there, because there's hope for Roger Kuhn and there's hope for you. We're at the top of page 84. All right, now we find a transition at the Brighton camp meeting, although not as much of a transition as we might expect. I'll show you why in a moment. 1894, Brighton camp meeting, Melbourne, Australia. Ellen White wrote at this time, "Meat is now absolutely banished from my table. From this time on, it is the understanding, whether I am at home or abroad, nothing of its kind is to be used in my family or come on my table." And at this time, she went to the unusual expedient of writing out a formal pledge to her Heavenly Father not to eat animal flesh. She didn't give up fish at this time. We'll come to that in a minute. But not to eat animal flesh anymore, and she signed it. A year later, no meat or butter on my table. 2 years later, not a particle of flesh of animals. 1899, the ban is still intact. We eat no meat or butter, and we use very little milk. 1903, we have on our table no butter, no meat, no cheese, no greasy mixtures of food. I still follow the light given me 35 years ago. I use no meat. And 1908, it is many years since I've had meat on my table at home. Now, let's look at the question of fish and shellfish, and we'll take shellfish up first. In 1882, Ellen White wrote her daughter-in-law, Willie's wife, in Oakland, 80 miles from Healdsburg, and sent her a shopping list of things to bring on the next visit to Healdsburg. Included was the request, "If you can get a good box of herrings, that is, fresh ones, please do so. The last ones that Willie got are bitter and old." Now, that isn't a problem. Herrings, I think, are clean fish by definition, aren't they, in Leviticus? But the next sentence, "If you can get a few cans of good oysters..." Now, what would a good oyster be? Would that be a Worthington oyster or a Loma Linda oyster? I don't think so. "If you can get a few cans of good oysters, get them." Now, the problem of herring is not really a scriptural problem. We will talk about fish in a minute. But here, let's examine the question of those oysters. There is evidence that the question of whether shellfish was permissible under the Levitical code was still not settled in the SDA church as late as 1882. In fact, in the very next year, 1883, W.H. Littlejohn was conducting a question and answer column in the pages of the Review, sources given you there, at which time he responded to the inquiry, writer wrote in, "Are oysters included among the unclean animals of Leviticus 11? Do you think it's wrong to eat them?" And Littlejohn replied, "It is difficult." This is 1883. "It is difficult to decide with certainty." He offered the private opinion that it probably was wrong, but he says it's really difficult to be dogmatic here. If you're interested in an in-depth study of this aspect, we do have a monograph by Ron Graybill, very good on the subject, "The Development of Adventist Thinking on Clean and Unclean Meats." And Elder Fagel here would be happy to supply you if you want one before you leave the campus. Okay, so much for the unclean. Now let's talk about clean fish. There is evidence that Ellen White drew a distinction between clean animal flesh food, or meat, and clean fish. And she did not totally discard fish when she abandoned meat as an article of diet. 1876, Ellen White wrote to her James, her husband, who was traveling, "We've not had a particle of meat in the house since you left and long before you left. We have had salmon a few times." 1895, in the same letter, she mentioned, in which she mentioned signing the vegetarian pledge, she also says that in many localities, even fish is unwholesome and ought not to be used. This is especially true where they come in contact with sewerage of large cities. Now, 1895, she is now a year after she signed the pledge, but notice we seldom have any fish on our table. And a year after that, she wrote in 1896 to Mary Clow Watson, who was the only non-Adventist literary helper that Ellen White is known to have had. Am I right on that, Bob? Did you talk about Mary Clow when you gave the talk on... Okay. I found out why Ellen White employed her. At least I think I came up with two reasons. Mary Clow was the daughter of Ellen's older sister, Carolyn. Now, you remember that Ellen and her twin sister, fraternal, not identical, Elizabeth, were the last two of eight children. Ellen had six other brothers and sisters who were older, and of course Elizabeth was a twin. Incidentally, several of the older siblings either married Methodist ministers or themselves were Methodist ministers. Keep in mind that by this time they had already left the home, and the visions of their younger sister would have come somewhat as a surprise, and they were already in their careers as Methodist clergy or wives of Methodist clergy. But anyway, Ellen hired young Mary Clow to become an assistant. She later married a man named Watson. She wanted to convert this niece. And so she hired her. The thing lasted somewhere between 1 and 2 years, and it created such problems that she finally let her go. She also wanted to convert her older sister, Carolyn, through the daughter, her niece. So she had two reasons for hiring this young lady. And I found a letter that Ellen wrote to Carolyn. I didn't find Carolyn's letter to her, but anyway, obviously, Ellen wrote to Carolyn and really leaned on her and told her, you know, she ought to be keeping the Sabbath. And we do have Ellen's reply to Carolyn's objection at pushing this thing. Carolyn thought she was leaning awfully hard, and Ellen wrote back to her and said, well, in your letter you said not to bother you about this, that you'd take your chances with the Lord when you met him. She said, that's pretty heavy, pretty dangerous. So apparently Carolyn had said, hey, quit leaning on me on this. I'll take my chances with the Lord. Anyway, this is what she wrote to that niece on Adventist. 2 years ago, 1894, I came to the conclusion that there was danger of using the flesh of dead animals. Since then, I have not used meat at all, never placed on my table. I use fish when I can get it. We can get beautiful fish from the saltwater lake near here. I use neither tea nor coffee. As I labor against these things, I cannot but practice that which I know to be best for my health, and my family are all in perfect harmony with me. You see, my dear niece, I am telling you matters just as they are. Which then brings us to the question of hypocrisy. Ellen White's definition of vegetarian was perhaps more broad than maybe yours and mine. Her definition of vegetarian was broad enough to include individuals who habitually practiced that mode of diet, but might occasionally partake of flesh articles under unusual and emergency situations. We've already noted Willie's statement that the White family were vegetarians but not teetotalers, and now we come to another interesting definition. 1894, Ellen White's in Australia, a non-Adventist woman active in temperance work writes and wonders about the position of Adventists as total abstainers. She wrote, I'm happy to assure you that as a denomination we are in the fullest sense total abstainers from the use of spirituous liquors, wine, beer, cider, and also tobacco and all other narcotics. And we're earnest workers in the cause of temperance. Now look at that next sentence. All, Seventh-day Adventists, all are vegetarians. Many abstaining wholly from the use of flesh foods, while others use it in only the most moderate degree. So Ellen White's definition of vegetarian would include people who maybe occasionally, in very moderate degree, would eat meat. Which then leads us to a consideration of the charge that she didn't live up to what she taught. She said, I've always acted from principle. And you'll notice that in the next couple of quotations at the bottom of 85 and about two or three of them on the top of 86, she keeps talking about principle. She dwelt on principles. 1870, she said, I left these things off from principle. I moved out from principle. 1908, I have not departed from principles. 1909, it's reported by some I've not followed the principles of health reform as I've advocated them, but I can say I've been a faithful health reformer. Which then leads me to something that may come as a surprise to you, and you may not agree with me. People sometimes don't. I will love you just as much if you promise to love me just as much. The accusation of hypocrisy by the critic is probably grounded on the assumption, which is incorrect, that Ellen White considered vegetarianism a principle. That she did not, I think, is clear from her writings. And now a couple of definitions. A principle we will define as a timeless, changeless rule of human behavior. Principles never change. They apply to all men in all times. Policies, on the other hand, are applications of some principle to meet a particular situation or circumstance. Policies do change as the circumstances which call them forth may change. However, the principle on which the policy is based will not change. It may have a different contemporary application than the one that's under immediate study. And I think that we can demonstrate that vegetarianism was not a principle with Ellen White, if indeed her definition of principle is that which I've suggested here, a timeless, changeless rule of human behavior, principles never change. Now, notice what she said. I have never felt it was my duty to say that no one should taste of meat under any circumstance. To say this would be carrying matters to extremes. I've never felt it was my duty to make sweeping assertions, 1895. And this was doubtless a further reason for her refusing to make vegetarianism a test of SDA church membership, volume 9, 159. Vegetarianism was not a principle of Christ or of the patriarchs and prophets of Scripture. They all ate flesh meat. The Passover required the eating of lamb and was done by divine direction. Christ and the apostles ate fish from Galilee. And I refuse to buy one explanation of a dear sister who really felt she had to come up with an explanation on this, and she said, well, Christ just didn't have the light we have. I can't buy that. Christ and the apostles ate fish from Galilee, and they ate lamb at Passover time. And in so doing, not a one of them violated principle, and none of them thereby committed sin. Vegetarianism, I think, for Ellen White, was a policy based on at least two principles which never change. The first, preserve the best health. That is a principle which always applies. Preserve the best health. And incidentally, if you just want to put a note in the margin, the reference on that's Use Instructor YI, May 31, 1894. And then the other one, do the best possible under every immediate circumstance to promote life, health, and strength. So preserve health and do the best you can under every immediate circumstance. Your goal is to promote life and health and strength. And if you want to make a note in the margin on that second one, Volume 9 of the Testimonies, 163. Ellen White says here, eat that food which is most nourishing. I think that will illustrate the second of the two principles which she operated on. And vegetarianism was a policy which arose out of those principles. Furthermore, Ellen White applied those principles in the context of vegetarianism by saying, in countries where there are fruits, grains, and nuts in abundance, flesh food is not the right people there for God's people. And to our call porters in 1889, she explicated a significant distinction. She said, I advise every Sabbath-keeping canvasser to avoid meat eating, not because it is regarded as a sin to eat meat, but because it is not healthful. Which brings us to our last page, page 87. And we've got 3 minutes on the clock. I wish I could do like Congress. They stop the clock when they want to go on. We can't. Historical perspective is helpful. Ellen White needs to be considered against the backdrop of her times rather than the backdrop of our times. Many household conveniences, such as refrigerators and food freezers for preserving fruits and vegetables and other edibles, were largely unknown in her day. And there were times in the year when fresh produce simply was not available and one virtually ate meat or he didn't eat at all. In terms of the common breakfast of today, it's well to remember that in 1863, oatmeal was not considered a breakfast staple, It was seen rather as a therapeutic remedy, and some kids would probably still agree. It was dispensed by pharmacies and sold by the ounce. The dry cereal breakfast foods were not invented and marketed by the Kellogg brothers until 1890s. Peanut butter, another source, excellent source of protein available to us, was not marketed before the middle 1890s when John Harvey Kellogg invented it. And I have had all kinds of people on this campus and elsewhere challenge me on that. When I gave this lecture in the seminary last January, about 8 of my black students took great exception, and they said, "You never heard of George Washington Carver?" I said, "Yes, I did. Have you heard some mythological information about him?" And I said, "I'll do my research if you do yours." And they said, "Where did you get this?" And I said, "I got this out of the doctoral dissertation of Richard Schwartz, the academic vice president of this university, and if you want to check it out, you can go over to the library and get his dissertation out as I did, and Schwartz documents that John Harvey Kellogg was the inventor of peanut butter." Also, there have been some recent articles in in-flight magazines on peanut butter, and Elbio Pereira, one of my colleagues in the office, found one last January in U.S. Air's in-flight magazine, and I found another one just a couple of days ago. Oh, you gave it to me a couple of days ago, which says that peanut butter was invented in 1890 by a physician in Cincinnati who remains unnamed and unknown, and therefore unhonored. Well, I don't know who invented peanut butter, but Schwartz in his dissertation says John Harvey Kellogg invented peanut butter, and he gives the sources of his data, so I don't know whether it was Kellogg, Carver, or the doctor in Cincinnati. But anyway, peanut butter, by general agreement, was not available before the middle 1890s in any kind of commercial quantity, and so they didn't have that as a source of protein. Meat eating was more common in those days and more necessary than it is perhaps for us today. Also, Ellen White never took meat away from anyone until there first was an adequate nutritional substitute available. And our present-day meat substitute health foods were not invented and marketed before 1895. So there was more reason and often more need for people to eat meat in her day than there is for us in ours. Which brings us to our conclusion. Ellen White had to face accusations against her integrity in her own lifetime. This is neither new nor startling. Within 4 years of her beginning to write on health, she was accused of borrowing the literary productions of certain contemporary health reformers. And shortly after the turn of the century, she was accused of hypocrisy, if not duplicity, in publicly mandating vegetarianism on her fellow church members, while she continued, allegedly, secretly, to follow a meat diet. She spoke and wrote vigorously and forthrightly in her own defense against these unfounded and unjustified charges. I have yet to see any new evidence since her death, in either category, which would provide additional proof of this alleged lack of integrity. The charges against integrity must be viewed from the broader perspective of Satan's objectives and methodology, and what has already been revealed as his very last deception in the church, the effort to destroy, if possible, her credibility and to create a satanic hatred against her writings. The case against her integrity, as far as I've been able to research to date, is still as unfounded and unproven as it was during the lifetime of the prophet.
This concludes another lecture from the 1986 E.G. White Estate Prophetic Guidance Seminar held at Andrews University. As a service to the church and in cooperation with the E.G. White Estate, this has been a Special American Cassette Ministries production. International copyright, 1986, all rights reserved.
To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.